This is Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. In recent years, Missouri has found itself in the center of an ongoing conversation on racial issues in America. And today, we're talking about how some people in Cape Girardeau are trying to address it. Reverend Renita Marie Green of St. James AME Church and Brooke Hildebrand Clubs, an instructor and the director of health communication for the Department of Communication Studies at Southeast, are just two of the four creators behind a new community conversation series on issues of race. Here's our conversation. Well, let's start off by talking about this, Brooke. How did these community conversations come about? What kind of triggered this for this community?
Well, it has sort of an interesting birth story. The first time that I met Renita was when she organized a very informal sort of vigil following the events in Charlottesville, Virginia. She just posted on Facebook, anybody that's feeling some kind of way about what happened, let's all get together. And so I went to that event, and it was beautiful. I would make the comparison to putting on your own oxygen mask before you put the oxygen mask on of the person next to you. It was just such a great opportunity to kind of get refreshed and ready to go and fight again. And so it's probably because of that oxygen that when I heard about something that had happened in the community that I live in Jackson, that I felt like I needed to do something about it. At a local coffee shop, a woman of color had noticed a sign in the window and had posted something on Facebook about how a sign that says back the blue can make people of color feel. And she received so much negative attention for that, that nobody seemed, the owners of the business didn't seem to step in. And I mean, this is a young woman. This is a student at Southeast. That it really showed me how much our community has to learn. And I don't know that any of these people who were saying these horrible things to her would classify themselves as racist, you know, but yet they were saying very racist things, and they were perpetuating a system that is racist. And that was most clearly evident when then she was fired from another business that she worked at in Jackson because the owners felt that it would be bad for business for her to continue to work there. And I just thought, this is systemic racism. This is seeing it in institutions. This is institutional racism. And so because I was feeling some kind of way about it, I contacted Renita. I contacted my friend Debbie Lee DiStefano, and then also my friend Lindsay Chapman, who's a social worker, and started talking about what we could do. And we came up with the idea of an economic kind of sit-in that we did at the business that had fired this young lady. But we said that this action is one thing. This shows the business that, you know, there are people in the community that don't agree with them. But we also felt that we needed to have conversations because people were noticing that we were there, and they noticed that we weren't ordering, but they don't think they really understood why this was a problem. And so we came up with the idea of the community conversations based on that, because we feel like it's important for people to have a safe space to ask these questions, to understand what racism is, to learn the vocabulary that they need, because what perpetuates it is silence, and particularly white silence. If we look at lynching that occurred in the late 1800s through the 1940s, it wasn't everybody that was doing the lynching. There were just, you know, these certain people that would do it, but it was the silence of all of the other white people that made them feel empowered to continue to do this. And so these community conversations were designed to give people the tools to not be silent.
Now, how did you get involved, Renita?
Because you're a troublemaker.
So Brooke contacted me, and I learned through the NAACP about the young girl who was fired from her job, and we were talking about how we could respond. But we were very committed to not responding for the young woman, but finding out what she wanted. And that's how we came up with the sit-in. We included her in that conversation. And she was included in the sit-in as well. So how did I get involved? I mean, we just kind of, I don't know, I think we were all just kind of drawn to each other. When mm-hmm. Brooke reached out to me, then we just continued the conversation. And to say, well, what's next? After the sit-in, we met to debrief and see what to do next. We didn't really have a conclusive plan then, mm-hmm. But we met maybe the next week or a few days later.
Mm-hmm.
And talked about these.
One of the things that accelerated it was that the young woman was still getting so much negative
yeah.
feedback. She felt that she couldn't
do anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so we really believe like that's our role. That particularly, I think I was really moved that she's so young, you know, and she's a child to us. I mean, right. like she's younger than my children. And these adults are bullying her, picking on her, harassing her. And so kind of the fighter in me, it's like pick on someone your own size.
Right.
you know, so you don't bring that mess to our young sister. Let's bring it here. We can handle it. We can take it. It hurts to hear that type of language. It hurts to hear that type of pain being spewed and violent language being spewed. But we can handle it.
Well, one thing that's interesting is that these conversations are specifically intended for people who are white. Why is that?
So it's tricky. And I'll own that because that was mostly me saying that. we don't want to burden our black friends with having to constantly be the ones explaining everything all the time. But it's tricky because we also don't want to exclude our black friends from participating in the conversation. So figuring out how to say, participate at your own risk. Come if you want to, if you want to share, but not burdening. I talked to my own children about how to talk about this. And they were like, yeah, it's going to be bad no matter what you say.
Right.
If you ask us to participate, we're going to feel obligated to participate. And if you don't ask us to participate, we're going to feel left out. So this was the best language we could come up with. It really is for white people to talk to white people about our stuff so that we can process and get better language and be able to talk at the Thanksgiving table when our racist relatives are talking ignorant talk, that we have a stronger language, we have more courage and boldness and feel the support of a community that is not afraid. And one of the interesting things after the conversation last week, a person came up to me and told me how it used to be and how losing your job would have been the best thing to happen to you, that you would have literally gotten run out of town. And if you got ran out of town, that would have even been better than the other options. And so there's a culture of people who are still alive today who remember a time when you could not advocate for people of color and live to tell the story mm-hmm. or continue in this community. And so there's still anxiety, there's still apprehension, there's still a culture of silence, and it's perpetuated by these stories that are continuously told. And then with the firing of the young girl in Jackson, that reinforces. So even if those stories seem like urban legends, then when this young woman is fired, it brings validity to those urban legends, and people revert back to their places of silence. So we want to provide opportunity for people to know that you don't have to be silent. And there's more of us who believe, and that was part of what we wanted to do at the sit-in. And we left a letter for the owners to say, if you stood on the side of right, we would come and support you on the side of right. There are a lot more people who love than there are who hate.
Well, why is this conversation important now for a community like Cape Girardeau, Brooke?
Well, I think we have a tendency to always assume that bad things happen other places and not in our own community. I know this from working with babies that have neonatal abstinence syndrome through my volunteer work, and people say, there are babies born addicted to drugs in this area? Or my friend who works for the Network Against Sexual Violence, and people say, there's sexual violence in this area? We have a tendency to, you know, want to believe that everything is beautiful and perfect and things are just fine. We're very concerned about our own little lives, and we sometimes don't want to look at the ugly parts of life. And so I think this is something that we have put off long enough that people somehow feel like it doesn't exist, but it does, and it's reality. And so particularly because of the incidents that we have seen from Charlottesville and then prior to that with, you know, some of the incidents of police shootings and those types of things, to help people realize, you know, here's a girl who got fired for just trying to educate people about how a sign like Back the Blue makes people of color possibly feel. There are people in our community who are stopped more often just because of the color of their skin. You know, that's statistical. That was in the paper today that we have seen the uptick in that. So if not now, when are we going to talk about it?
Why is it a challenge for people who are white to talk about racial issues? Why is that a constant challenge? You know, during the times of the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, very iconic times for social change, and these conversations have been had for decades now. So why is it still a challenge?
Particularly when we talk about white privilege, that's a term that has gained more traction in recent years. And so particularly folks who have come from lower socioeconomic status and believe they have worked very hard, and they have worked very hard, who are white, say, I'm not privileged. I had to work hard for everything that I got. And so there's a lot of defensiveness, mm-hmm. I think. And so that makes it difficult to talk about. And the other reason I think that, you know, Renita said this is for white people, again, wasn't to segregate. It was to not burden our friends of color to feel like they had to tell these stories. And also, though, so that people who want to not be silent but are afraid to ask questions, are afraid of being in the minority of walking into a room and having a lot of black people tell them how it is, could know this is designed for you to ask a question that, you know, you might be afraid to ask.
And I think there's a lot of shame. You know, we don't want to be known as racist. And typically, if we ask a person, do you feel like you're racist? Or the first thing they'll say is, I'm not racist. One of the most popular little comebacks is, not all white people. You know, we don't want to be associated with those white people. And we're good people. And particularly in Cape Girardeau, I've met so many good people. I mean, just they're good people. But when we perpetuate a system that was designed to prosper some while not considering the prosperity and the success of mm-hmm. others, and sometimes that becomes the problem. We don't see ourselves as intentionally doing harm. We don't say, I set out to hurt someone, or the system is set out to hurt. But if the system is only set out or set up for certain people to succeed, then other people being hurt by the system by default doesn't make us not guilty. We're still guilty of systemic racism. We're guilty by participation. We're guilty by association. And that's hard for us to admit that we're guilty. We don't want to be guilty. And it's hard for us to wrap our brain around it, because when we think about racist and racism, we think about those tiki torchers. Mm-hmm. We think about the people with the white hoods, and that's what we think racists are. But that's extremism. That isn't everyday racism. Everyday racism, and I said this last week, is when this sweet little grandma says, you know, I don't know why they're raising such a fuss. We're good to our black people. You know, we treat our black people good. And actually, I was told here in this city that I needed to stop stirring things up because I can relax because we're good to our black people here, Reverend. That's what I was told. And that was last year. You know, that wasn't 100 years ago. So So when people have this sense that they're good people and they're trying to do good things, and we don't understand how even our best intentions miss the mark, it can also feel very deflating and make us feel like, well, no matter what I do, if right. I say this, I'm a racist. If I do that, I'm a racist. Everything is being a racist, so therefore nothing is being a racist. And people shut down and they pull away from the conversation. So it's very tricky being able to provide that space for us to be able to see ourselves, to see the best of who we can be, to believe the best of who we can be, and purge from us the stuff that we didn't even place inside ourselves.
Well, one thing that was interesting that night, you shared a ton of personal experiences, one of which goes into your children who are biracial. And you talked about some of your fears about things that they might experience. Could you talk more about that?
Sure. So you talk about my children being biracial, which they are. I'm their white mother, but they are not looked at as biracial children. When they are out in the world, they are black children, and they have had to figure out their own sense of identity and how to be black children with a white mother in this world. So one of the stories that I shared was being in the mall, and they were young and always wanted to go to the mall, middle school. My sense of parenting was not to leave 12 and 13-year-olds at the mall by themselves. But I would tag behind them. That was kind of the grace that I gave them. I wouldn't hound them. And I would see people. One memory, this woman clutched her purse and pressed her body against the, what do you call those windows? The display window,
oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And she... like, is she going to go through the glass? I mean, and my son was with four other friends, so there's these five. And it's just so bizarre to me. My son was small for his age. Like, I'm not a very tall woman, and he didn't even come up to my shoulders when he was in middle school. But they're loud. Oh, they are so loud, and their hands go everywhere, and they are pushing each other as they walk down them. Corridor, and they're giggling, and this woman was terrified. And several times this mall security followed them throughout the mall. My daughter would be at the same mall with her friends. She's a little older, so I tried to give them more space. So that this continued, and eventually I kind of like sat in the food court, and I would listen for them. If I can hear you, I'm coming to you, I would tell them. You have to be quiet enough. So if I hear you from the food court, I'm going to be right there walking with you. So they, you know, would chill a little bit. So when they pressed me enough, they felt like they were old enough to be at the mall by themselves. And after all, I was the only parent there. Like, all their other friends were at the mall by themselves, except they weren't. I was there. What I told them in all seriousness was, don't scare the white people. Don't scare the white folks. That's when security gets involved, when you scare the white people. So what scares white people? We had this conversation before they got out of our van. Noise, motion, movement, aggression. But Mom, we're just playing. They don't understand your play. They are afraid of you, and they will call security, and I might not be able to get you out of trouble. Don't scare the white people. Then it became kind of a joke after a while, and they kind of laugh about it now, but you could see the pain and the embarrassment in their face. And the only other time, the first time I saw that look was my son was 11. We just moved into this neighborhood. It was a neighborhood of cul-de-sacs. We drove around. I showed my son his boundaries. And I don't know. I think it was our first weekend there. I got a knock at the door. And it was a policeman on my front porch. My son was weeping, standing at the police car. My first thought was that he was hurt. The policeman said, "Is this kid yours? Is this kid really yours?" "My son?" He said, "Oh, well, we got a call about kids riding their bikes looking in windows," and he fit the description of the call that came in. And he was just riding. And then he said he didn't know where he lived. I'm like, because he just moved here, and he probably doesn't really know, and he's terrified. And the policeman said, "Well, we didn't get any reports of a new black family in the neighborhood." "You get reports on new black families in the neighborhood?" The terror that was in my son's eyes, that look is etched into my soul. And that's the look that I've seen on his face so many times, and I've seen on other young people's face. So the first time when I left them at the mall by themselves, and I have to let them out of the van with this look of disgust and terror and shame, I drive around to the back of the mall, and I go in to where the security office is, and I say, "Okay, I just dropped off this group of black children, and here's what my children look like, and I'm going to be in the van right outside this door, and if you have any issues, they are not unsupervised. I am right here. You come get me." There weren't any issues. There were never any issues. But we had to, that's how we have to live. Because when the white folks get scared, the black kids get in trouble, whether they did anything or not. And when they get in trouble and they didn't do anything, everything escalates. "Why are you picking on me? Why are you, why?" And then it goes up and up. And then they sometimes do stuff that warrants them getting in trouble, which they never would have done had they not been pulled out to begin with.
I saw you getting emotional describing those stories, and they're not easy experiences to see as a parent, but you're seeing it from a whole different perspective. We had talked about white privilege earlier, and so you're seeing it as a white woman, seeing who the world sees as a black child, experience injustices that perhaps you might not have been accustomed to growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been a challenge, seeing that reversal?
It is a challenge, particularly when the children were younger. Is what we're taught is if you get in trouble, you deserve to get in trouble. If you get pulled over by the police, you deserve to get pulled over by the police. If the adult said you did it, you did it. If the teacher said you were guilty, you were guilty. So my daughter was 7th grade, this affluent school in the St. Louis County area. She's saying, "The teacher won't teach her. The teacher won't teach her." This does not make any sense. Of course the teacher is going to teach you. She had always excelled in math, and now all of a sudden she's failing. "Well, I'm figuring it's just a transition issue, blah, blah, blah." We have a conference with the teacher. The teacher pats my hand and says, "Well, I'm sure you didn't realize this when you got her." "When I got her?" But statistically, she has two things against her. She's black and she's a girl. And statistically, blacks and girls don't do so well in the math and sciences. So you just tell her to cooperate and I'll make sure she and her friends pass. They just can't disrupt the other learners. What? So when white people think that I got my kids, I was actually asked one time, "Where did you get them?" Sears and Roebuck, items A and B, black girl, black boy. when they think I got my kids, then I'm like this great white person that, you know, got black kids.
Saved them.
Yeah. But when they realize that these are the fruit of my womb, then I'm a whole different type of white person. So I've seen it from those angles. I've experienced it when white people think that I will go along with white speak. Then there's one tone of voice. There's inclusion. There's all kinds of privileges. And I learned a term for is learning to be white. And when I heard about this term, learning to be white, we learn to be white by the carrot or the stick. So when I was a child and I had a black friend, and I was told I couldn't have a black friend, and I got whipped until my legs bled. That was the stick. But my sister, who told on me for having the black friend and who was rewarded, that's the carrot. And even as an adult, I've been given the opportunity to kind of explain my involvement in black community and to apologize. Oh, you must have been going through a hard time. Oh, you must have had a traumatic experience. So if there's a reason that that pushed me over the edge, then it's understandable. But when it's understood that I'm not just serving this church because, you know, somebody sent me and made me serve the black church, but this is my church of choice and that this is my community of choice, then I'm treated very differently. And so privilege is extended to white people. And we choose whether we accept it and embrace it. We choose whether we give it back.
Brooke, I want to ask you, you are a parent. Mm-hmm. How do you have these conversations about race with your children?
I have three children. Ava is 15, Eli is 12, and Lily is 8. And it's just sort of always been a part of something that we have talked about. My mother was a professor at Governor State University near Chicago, and so I grew up seeing more diversity and seeing that the people who were walking in the hallways matched the people that were in the offices at that university. There was great diversity among the professors and the staff, so I had the benefit of that as well. And so my mom would back me up when I would be telling these things. You know, my mom could talk about marching with Martin Luther King when she was in college. So my kids have kind of grown up with this, which has in a way made them social deviants.
Social deviants.
Yes. That they vary from the norm. And so when an opinion is expressed in school and they think, that's not what my mom told me, they will say that. And then they sometimes reap the consequences of that. You know, whether it's friends not being their friends anymore, or whether it's a teacher telling them, well, we're not talking about that. So they have to come home sometimes, and I have to say, I know that, you know, that it's hard, but just know that, you know, we're really proud of you for standing up and saying these things. But it's difficult. We've made, you know, just like Renita says, in the way that white privilege is extended, It depends on what kind of a white person you are. And I had just told her my son was at a friend's house this weekend, and the parents had invited some folks over to watch a football game. And he overheard them talking about the incident that we started off here discussing in Jackson. And they were saying, boy, that girl, you know, well, she, you know, learned her lesson, you know, and they were saying lots of negative things about the girl who had made the original comments. And they said, oh, did you see somebody started a GoFundMe page for her? That's ridiculous. And so Eli, you know, told me that and goes, Mom, weren't you the one that started that? And I said, yeah, honey, because, you know I didn't have any money if I wasn't working when I was in school. You know, it's important. And I didn't want her to, you know, have to sacrifice something because she had lost her job unjustly. And I said, a lot of people contributed. He goes, yeah, I kind of thought about saying that you started it, but they weren't really talking to me. And I said, well, what would have motivated you to say something? He said, well, if they would have said the N-word, I would have called you and Dad and had you come get me. And I thought, you know, for him as a young boy, the idea of don't disrespect your elders, you know, is what keeps him quiet. And so that's a fine line that, you know, we kind of have to walk, to speak out for justice. But you can also then be perceived as being, mm-hmm. You know, disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that my husband and I try to balance.
Mm-hmm. Well, how should people combat racism?
It's going to depend on where you are. It's going to look a little bit different for everyone. Because what stems from the conversation is action. And, you know, we just commemorated 9/11, and that was when we started talking about if you see something, say something. And that also became a great way to profile people who were brown or people who were speaking mm-hmm. Arabic. I would say let's turn that around to if you see something, say something. If you are in a situation where you see someone being harassed, go talk to the person that's being harassed. At that time, if someone's being so bold as to do harassing out in the open, you might not get anywhere with them. But go talk to the person who is being harassed. Let them be seen and make them feel safe when they're in that situation. But if you are Facebook friends with someone who posts a jingoist meme, posts something racist, don't be afraid to perhaps send them a private message and say, we need to talk about this. I want to tell you what I hear when you say things like that. When you're at work and a policy is happening, if you're a part of the hiring committee and they say, this person just doesn't seem like a good fit, and you also know that that is a woman of color, you might say, why don't they seem like a good fit? Because they've got that PhD and they've got this and they've got that. What is it that doesn't seem like a good fit to you? It's having to be brave and step out in the situations you're in. The situations I'm in are different than the ones Renita is in, are different than the ones, you know, a lot of listeners might be in. So it's where you are, when you see it, you say something. And the people that we have leading these conversations are, you know, we kind of call them experts. They're people who have studied diversity and ethics. Tamara Zellers-Buck has studied diversity and its role in the media. And Debbie Lee DiStefano has studied, you know, the role of race in all of these, you know, different scenarios. And I teach intercultural communication. And, you know, we all have these different areas of expertise. And so you know it's coming from a credible source. But then you take that information and you are the opinion leader, you're the thought leader, you're the friend that people are more likely to listen to than they might an expert. And so that's very, very important. Just because you're not an expert doesn't mean that you're not important in addressing it when you see it where you are.
Mm-hmm. Anything you want to add, Renita, to that?
I'll add that, and I said this last week, it's different to be not a racist and an anti-racist. And not a racist is noble, you know, but anti-racist is the goal. And so anti-racists are going to ask the questions. You're going to be able to see things like 99% of the alternative school in Cape Girardeau is African-American children and start asking the questions, why is this? And how do we undo this? How do we make this not true? Being anti-racist is not just dealing with the issues that come across your personal path, but dealing with them in a broader sector, in a broader society. And there is a risk at that, because when you start taking steps, I've been told to stay in my place more since I've been in Cape Girardeau than I have my entire life. Stay in your place. Know your place. Stay in your place. Know your place. But my place is with the people. And so when we're committed that to our position and to know that that being anti-racist is not being violent or vicious, but is absolutely insisting that the power of love prevail in every situation and not being settled with ill treatment of any individual, systemically or individually. I think that's what we're called to do. That's the do. That's the do. So Brooke talked about the individual do, when mm-hmm. the people are right in front of you, your neighbor, your friend. And then there's the do that's much larger than anyone you will ever meet.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's our show. To hear an extended version of my conversation with Reverend Renita Marie Green and Brooke Hildebrand Clubs on the new Community Conversations on Race, visit krcu.org or go to iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me Friday nights at 6 for KRCU's Going Public.